Chapter 38. Prince of Babylon, Knight of the Black Cross, Knight of Death, Sublime Master of the Luminous Ring, Priest of the Sun, Grand Architect, Knight of the Black and White Eagle, Holy Royal Arch, Knight of the Phoenix, Knight of Iris, Priest of Eleusis, Knight of the Golden Fleece. High grades of the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite. We walked along the corridor, climbed three steps, went through a frosted glass door, and abruptly entered another universe. The rooms I had seen so far were dark, dusty, with peeling paint, but this looked like a VIP lounge at an airport. Soft music, a plush waiting room with designer furniture, pale blue walls decorated with photographs showing gentlemen who looked like members of parliament presenting winged victories to gentlemen who looked like senators. On a coffee table, as in a dentist's office, were slick magazines, in casual disarray, with titles like Literature and Wit, The Poetic Athenor, The Rose and the Thorn, The Italic Parnassus, Free Verse. I had never seen any of them before, and I later found out why. They were distributed only to minutious clients. At first I thought these were the offices of the Garamond directors, but I soon learned otherwise. This was another publishing firm entirely. The Garamond lobby had a little glass case, dusty and clouded, displaying the latest publications, but the books were unassuming, with uncut pages and sober gray covers imitating French university publications. The paper was the kind that turned yellow in a few years, giving the impression that the author, no matter how young, had been publishing for a long time. But here the glass case, lighted inside, displayed minutious books, some of them opened to reveal bright pages. They had gleaming white covers, sheathed in elegant transparent plastic, with handsome rice paper and clean print. Whereas the Garamond catalogue contained such scholarly series as Humanist Studies and Philosophia, the minutious series were delicately poetically named. The Flower Unplucked, poetry. Terra Incognita, fiction. The Hour of the Oleander, including Diary of a Young Girl's Illness. Easter Island, assorted nonfiction, I believe. New Atlantis, the most recent release being Königsberg Revisited, prolegomena to any future metaphysics presented as both a transcendental system and a science of the phenomenal noumenon. On every cover was the firm's logo, a pelican under a palm tree, with the Danunzian motto, "I have what I have given." Belbo had been laconic. Signor Garamond owned two publishing houses. In the days that followed, I realized that the passageway between Garamond and Minutius was private and secret. The official entrance to Minutius Press was on Via Marchese Gualdi, the street in which the purulent world of Via Sincero Renato, ceded to spotless facades, spacious sidewalks, lobbies with aluminum elevators. No one could have suspected that an apartment in an old Via Sincero Renato building might be joined by a mere three steps to a building on Via Marchese Gualdi. To obtain permission for this, Signor Garamond must have had to perform feats of persuasion. I believe he had help from one of his authors, an official in the City Planning Bureau. We were received promptly by Signora Grazia, bland and matronly, her designer scarf and suit the exact color of the walls. With a guarded smile, she showed us into an office that recalled Mussolini's. The room was not so immense, but it suggested that hall in the Palazzo Venezia. Here, too, there was a globe near the door, and at the far end the mahogany desk of Signor Garamond, who seemed to be looking at us through reversed binoculars. He motioned us to approach, and I felt intimidated. Later, when De Gubernatis came in, Garamond got up and went to greet him, an act of cordiality that enhanced even more the publisher's importance. The visitor first watches him across the room, then crosses it himself, arm in arm with his host, and as if by magic the space is doubled. Garamond waved us to seats opposite his desk. He was brusque but friendly.
"Dr. Belbo speaks highly of you, Dr. Kasavin. We need good men. You realize, of course, we're not putting you on the staff. Can't afford it. But you'll be well paid for your efforts, for your devotion, if I may say so, because I consider our work a mission."
He mentioned a flat fee based on estimated hours of work. It seemed reasonable for those times. I accepted.
"Excellent, Kasavin."
Now that I was an employee, the title disappeared.
This history of metals, he went on, must be splendid. More, a thing of beauty. Popular, but scholarly, too. It must catch the reader's imagination. An example. Here in the first draft there is mention of these spheres. What were they called? Yes, the Magdeburg hemispheres. Two hemispheres which, when put together and the air is pumped out, create a pneumatic vacuum inside. Teams of draft horses are hitched to them and they pull in opposite directions. The horses can't separate the hemispheres. This is scientific information, but it's special. It's picturesque. You must single it out from all the other information, then find the right image, a fresco, an oil, whatever, and we'll give it a full page in color. There's an engraving I know of, I said. You see? Bravo! A whole page, full color. Since it's an engraving, it'll have to be in black and white, I said. Really? Fine, black and white it is. Accuracy above all. But against a gold background. It has to strike the reader, make him feel he's there on the day the experiment was carried out. See what I mean? Science, realism, passion. With science, you can grab the reader by the throat. What could be more dramatic than Madame Curie coming home one evening and seeing that phosphorescent glow in the dark? Oh, my goodness, whatever can that be? Hydrocarbon, Golconda, phlogiston, whatever the hell they called it, and voila, Marie Curie invents X-rays. Dramatize, but with absolute respect for the truth. What connection do X-rays have with metals? I asked. Isn't radium a metal? Yes. Well, then, the entire body of knowledge can be viewed from the standpoint of metals. What did we decide to call the book, Belbo? We were thinking of something sober, like metals. Yes, it has to be sober. But with that extra hook, that little detail that tells the whole story, let's see. Metals, a world history. Are there Chinese in it, too? Yes. Ah, world, then. Not an advertising gimmick, it's the truth. Oh, wait, I know. The wonderful adventure of metals. It was at that moment Signora Grazia announced the arrival of Commendatore de Gubernatis. Signor Garamond hesitated, gave me a dubious look. Belbo made a sign as if to say I could be trusted. Garamond ordered the guest to be shown in and went to greet him. De Gubernatis wore a double-breasted suit, a rosette in his lapel, a fountain pen in his breast pocket, a folded newspaper in his side pocket, a leatherette briefcase under his arm. "Ah, my dear Commendatore," Garamond said. "Come right in. Our dear friend de Ambrosis told me all about you. A life spent in the service of the state, and a secret poetic vein, yes? Show me the treasure you hold in your hands. But first let me introduce two of my senior editors." He seated the visitor in front of the desk, cluttered with manuscripts, while his hands, trembling with anticipation, caressed the cover of the work held out to him. "Not a word. I know everything. You come from Vitipeno, that great and noble city. You were in the customs service, and secretly, night after night, you filled these pages, fired by the demon of poetry. Poetry! It consumed Sappho's young years, it nourished Goethe's old age. Drug, the Greeks called it, both poison and medicine. Naturally, we'll have to read this creation of yours. I always insist on at least three readers' reports, one in-house and two from consultants, who must remain anonymous, you'll forgive me, but they are quite prominent people. Minucius doesn't publish a book unless we're sure of its quality. And quality, as you know better than I, is an impalpable. It can be detected only with a sixth sense. A book may have imperfections, flaws. Even Savevo sometimes wrote badly, as you know better than I. But, by God, you still feel the idea, rhythm, power. I know, don't say it. The moment I glanced at the incipit of your first page, I felt something. But I don't want to judge on my own, though time and again, yes, often, when the reader's reports were lukewarm, I overruled them, because you can't judge an author without having grasped, so to speak, his rhythm. And here, for example, I open this work of yours at random and my eyes fall on a verse. As in autumn the wan eyelid. Well, I don't know how it continues, but I sense an inspiration. I see an image. There are times you start a work like this with a surge of ecstasy, carried away. Cela dit, my dear friend, if we could only always do what we like. But publishing, too, is a business, perhaps the noblest of all, but still a business. Do you have any idea what printers charge these days? And the cost of paper? Just look at this morning's news, the rise of the prime rate on Wall Street. Doesn't affect us, you say? Ah, but it does. Do you know they tax even our inventory? And they tax returns, the books I don't sell. Yes, I pay even for failure. Such is the calvary of genius unrecognized by the Philistines. This onion skin, most refined of you, if I may say so, to type your text on such thin paper. It smacks of the poet. The typical clod would have used parchment to dazzle the eye and confuse the spirit, but here is poetry written with the heart. This onion skin might as well be paper money.
The phone rang. I later learned that Garamond had pressed a button under the desk, and Signora Grazia had sent through a fake call.
My dear maestro! What? Splendid! Great news! Ring out, wild bells! A new book from your pen is always an event. Why, of course, Minucius is proud, moved, more, thrilled, to number you among its authors. You saw what the papers wrote about your latest epic poem? Nobel material? Unfortunately, you're ahead of your time. We had trouble selling the 3,000 copies.
Commendatore de Gubernatis blanched. 3,000 copies was an achievement beyond his dreams.
Sales didn't cover the production costs. Take a look through the glass doors and you'll see how many people I have in the editorial department. For a book to break even nowadays, I have to sell at least 10,000 copies. And luckily I sell more than that in many cases, but those are writers with, well, how shall I put it, a different vocation. Balzac was great and his books sold like hotcakes. Proust was equally great, but he published at his own expense. You'll end up in the school anthologies, but not on the stands in train stations. The same thing happened to Joyce, who, like Proust, published at his own expense. I can allow myself the privilege of bringing out a book like yours once every 2 or 3 years. Give me 3 years' time.
A long pause followed. An expression of pained embarrassment came over Garamond's face.
What? At your own expense? No, no, it's not the amount. We can hold the costs down. But as a rule, Minucius doesn't... Of course, you're right. Even Joyce and Proust. Of course, I understand.
Another pained pause.
Very well, we'll talk about it. I've been honest with you, and you're impatient. Let's try what the Americans call a joint venture. They're always way ahead of us, the Yanks. Drop in tomorrow and we'll do some figuring. Oh, my respects and my admiration.
Garamond seemed to wake from a dream. He rubbed his eyes, then suddenly remembered the presence of his visitor.
Oh, forgive me.
That was a writer, a true writer, perhaps one of the greats. And yet, for that very reason, sometimes this job is humbling. If it weren't for the vocation.
But where were we? Ah, yes, I think we've said everything there is to be said now. I'll write you, in about a month. Please leave your work here. It's in good hands.
Commendatore de Gubernatis went out, speechless. He had set foot in the forge of glory. Chapter 39. Doctor of the Planispheres, Hermetic Philosopher, Grand Elect of the Aeons, Knight Prince of the Rose of Herodom, Grand Master of the Temple of Wisdom, Knight Noachite, Wise Sibiast, Knight Supreme Commander of the Stars, Sublime Sage of the Zodiac, Shepherd King of the Hoots, Interpreter of Hieroglyphs, Sage of the Pyramids, Sublime Titan of the Caucasus, Orphic Doctor, Sublime Skald, Prince Brahman, Guardian of the Three Fires. Grades of the Ancient and Primitive Memphis Mizraim Rite. Minucius was a publishing house for SFAs. An SFA, in Minucian jargon, was... But why do I use the past tense? SFAs still exist, after all. Back in Milan, all continues as if nothing has happened, and yet I cast everything into a tremendously remote past. What occurred 2 nights ago in the nave of Saint-Martin-des-Champs has made a rent in time, reversing the order of the centuries. Or perhaps it is simply that I have aged decades overnight, or that the fear that they will find me makes me speak as if I were now chronicling a collapsing empire, as I lie in the balneum with my veins severed, waiting to drown in my own blood.
An SFA is a self-financing author, and Minutius is a vanity press. Earnings high, overhead minuscule. A staff of four, Garamond, Signora Grazia, the bookkeeper in the cubbyhole in the back, and Luciano, the disabled shipping clerk in the vast storeroom in the half-basement. "I've never figured out how Luciano manages to pack books with one arm," Belbo once said to me. "I believe he uses his teeth. However, he doesn't have all that much packing to do. Normal publishers ship to booksellers, but Luciano ships only to authors. Minutius isn't interested in readers. The main thing, Signor Garamond says, is to make sure the authors remain loyal to us. We can get along fine without readers." Belbo admired Signor Garamond. He felt the man possessed a strength that he himself lacked. "The Minutius system is very simple. A few ads are placed in local papers, professional magazines, provincial literary reviews, especially those that tend to survive for only a few issues. Medium-sized announcements with a photograph of the author and a few incisive lines. A lofty voice in our nation's poetry, or the latest narrative achievement by the author of Floriana and Her Sisters." "At this point the net is cast," Belbo explained, "and the SFAs fall into it in clumps, if you can fall into a net in clumps." "And then?" "Well, take De Gubernatis, for example. A month from now, as our retired customs official writhes with anxiety, a call from Signor Garamond will invite him to dinner with a few writers. They'll meet in the latest Arab restaurant, very exclusive, no sign outside. You ring the bell and give your name through a peephole. Deluxe interior, soft lights, exotic music. Garamond will shake the maitre d's hand, call the waiters by name, and send back the first bottle of wine because the vintage isn't right. Or else he'll say, 'Excuse me, old friend, but this isn't couscous the way we eat it in Marrakesh.' De Gubernatis will be introduced to Inspector X. All the airport services are under his command, but his real claim to fame is that he is the inventor and apostle of Cosmoranto, the language of universal peace now being considered by UNESCO. There's also Professor Y, a remarkable storyteller, winner of the Petruzzelli's Delegatina Prize in 1980, but also a leading figure in medical science. How many years did you teach, Professor? Ah, those were other times. Education then was taken seriously. And finally, our charming poetess, the exquisite Odalinda Mezzofanti Sassabetti, author of Chaste Throbs, which you've surely read." Belbo told me that he had long wondered why all female SFAs use a double surname. Lauretta Solemeni Calcanti, Dora Ardensi Fiamma, Carolina Pastorelli Cefalu. Why was it that important women writers had just one surname, except for Ivy Compton Burnett, and some, like Colette, had none at all, while an SFA felt the need to call herself Odalinda Mezzofanti Sassabetti? Perhaps because real writers wrote out of love of the work and didn't care whether they were known. They could even use a pseudonym like Nerval. Whereas an SFA wanted to be recognized by the family next door, by the people in her neighborhood, and in the neighborhood where she used to live. For a man, one surname is enough, but not for a woman, because there are some who knew her before her marriage and some who only met her afterward, hence the need for two. "Anyway," Belbo went on, "it is an evening rich in intellectual experiences. De Gubernatis will feel as if he's drained an LSD cocktail. He'll listen to the gossip of his fellow guests, hear a tasty anecdote about a great poet who is notoriously impotent, and not worth much as a poet either. He'll look, eyes glistening with emotion, at the latest edition of the Encyclopedia of Illustrious Italians, which Garamond will just happen to have on hand, to show Inspector X the appropriate page. You see, my dear friend, you too have entered the Pantheon. Ah, it is mere justice." Belbo showed me the encyclopedia. "Just an hour ago I was preaching at you, but nobody is innocent. The encyclopedia is compiled exclusively by Diotelevi and me, but I swear we don't do it just for the money. It's one of the most amusing jobs there is. Every year we have to prepare a new updated edition. It works more or less this way. You include an entry on a famous writer and an entry on an SFA, making sure they're in alphabetical proximity. And you don't waste space on the famous name. See, for example, under L. Lampedusa, Giuseppe Tomasi D., 1896-1957. Sicilian writer, long ignored, achieved fame posthumously for his novel, The Leopard. Lampustri, Adeodato, 1919-2. Writer, educator, veteran, Bronze Star, East Africa. Thinker, novelist, and poet. looms large on the contemporary Italian literary scene. Lampustri's talent was revealed in 1959 with the publication of The Carmassi Brothers, Volume 1 of a trailblazing trilogy. Narrated with unrelenting realism and noble poetic inspiration, the novel tells of a fisherman's family in Lucania. The Carmassi brothers won the Petruzzelli's della Gattina Prize in 1960, and was followed a few years later by The Dismissed and Panther Without Eyelashes, both of which, perhaps even more than the author's initial work, exhibit the epic sweep, the dazzling plastic invention, the lyrical flow that distinguished this incomparable artist. A diligent ministry official, Lampustri is esteemed by those who know him as a man of upright character, an exemplary father and husband, and a stunning public speaker. "The Gubernatis," Belbo explained, "will want to appear in the encyclopedia. He's always said that the fame of the famous was a fraud, a conspiracy on the part of obliging critics. But chiefly he wants to join a family of writers who are also directors of state agencies, bank managers, aristocrats, magistrates. Appearing in the encyclopedia, he will expand his circle of acquaintances. If he needs to ask a favor, he'll know where to turn. Signor Garamond has the power to lift De Gubernatis out of the provinces and hurl him to the summit." Toward the end of the dinner, Garamond will whisper to him to drop by the office the next morning. And the next morning he comes. Oh, you can bet on it. He'll spend a sleepless night dreaming of the greatness of Adeodato Lampustri. And then? Garamond will say to him, "Yesterday, I didn't dare speak. It would have humiliated the others. But your work, it's sublime." Not only were the readers' reports enthusiastic, no, more, favorable. "But I personally spent an entire night poring over these pages of yours. A book worthy of a literary prize. Great, really great." Then Garamond will go back to his desk, slap the manuscript, now well-worn by the loving attention of at least four readers, rumpling the manuscripts is Signora Grazia's job, and stare at the SFA with a puzzled expression. "What shall we do with it?" And, "What shall we do with it?" De Gubernatis will ask. Garamond will say that the work's value is beyond the slightest dispute, but clearly it is ahead of its time. And as for sales, it won't do more than 2,000 copies, 2,500 tops. Well, 2,000 more than covers all the people De Gubernatis knows, and an SFA doesn't think in planetary terms. Or rather, his planet consists of familiar faces. Schoolmates, bank managers, fellow teachers in the high school, retired colonels. The SFA wants to bring his poetry to all these people, even to those who couldn't care less, like the butcher or the prefect of police. Faced by the risk that Garamond might back off, and remember, everybody at home, in town and office, knows that De Gubernatis has submitted his manuscript to a big Milan publisher, he will make some quick calculations. He could empty his savings account, take out a loan against his pension, mortgage the house, cash in those few government bonds. Paris is well worth a mass. Shyly, he will offer to underwrite some of the costs. Garamond will look upset. "Oh, that is not the usual practice of Minutius, but, well, all right, it's a deal, you've talked me into it. Even Proust and Joyce had to bow to harsh necessity. The costs are so high. For the present, we'll plan on 2,000 copies, though the contract will provide for up to 10,000. You'll receive 200 authors' copies to send to anyone you like. Another 200 will be review copies, because we want to promote the book as if this were the new Stephen King. That leaves 1,600 for commercial distribution. On these, obviously, no royalties for you, but if the book catches on and we go into a second printing, you'll get 12%. Later I saw the standard contract that De Gubernatis, now on his poetic trip, would sign without even reading, while Signor Garamond's bookkeeper loudly protested that the costs had been grossly underestimated. 10 pages of clauses in 8-point type. Foreign rights, subsidiary rights, dramatizations, radio and television serialization, film rights, braille editions, abridgments for Reader's Digest, guarantees against libel suits, all disputes to be settled by Milan courts. The SFA, lost in dreams of glory, would not notice the clause that specified a maximum print run of 10,000, but mentioned no minimum, or the clause that said the amount to be paid by the author was independent of the print run, which was agreed upon only verbally, or the clause that said, most important of all, that the publisher had the right to pulp all unsold copies after 1 year, unless the author wished to buy them at half the list price.
Sign on the dotted line. The launching would be lavish. 10-page press releases with biography and critical essays. No modesty, the newspaper editors would toss them out anyway. The actual printing, 1,000 copies, of which only 350 would be bound. 200 to the author, about 50 to minor or associated bookshops, 50 to provincial magazines, about 30 to the newspapers, just in case they needed to fill a couple of lines in the books received column. These copies would later be given as donations to hospitals or prisons. And you can see why the former don't heal and the latter don't redeem. In summer, the Petrucelis Delegatina Prize, a Garamond creation, would be awarded. Total cost, 2 days' meals and lodgings for the jury, plus a Nike of Samothrace, in Vermeil, for the winner. Congratulatory telegrams from other minutious authors. Finally, the moment of truth. A year and a half later, Garamond writes, "Dear friend, as I feared, you are 50 years ahead of your time. Rave reviews in the dozens, awards, critical acclaim, ça va sentir. But few copies sold. The public is not ready. We are forced to make space in the warehouse as stipulated in the contract, copy enclosed. Unless you exercise your right to buy the unsold copies at half the list price, we must pulp them." De Gubernatis goes mad with grief. His relatives console him. "People just don't understand you. Of course, if you belong to the right clique, if you sent the requisite bribe, by now they'd have reviewed you in the Corriere della Sera. It's all mafia. You have to hold out." Only 5 authors' copies are left, and there are still so many important people to whom the work should go. You can't allow your writing to be pulped, recycled into toilet paper. Let's see how much we can scrape together. Maybe we can buy back 500 copies. And for the rest, sic transit gloria mundi. Minucius still has 650 copies in unbound sheets. Signor Garamond has 500 of them bound and shipped, COD. The final balance? The author paid the production costs for 2,000 copies, Minucius printed 1,000 and bound 850, of which 500 were paid for a second time. About 50 authors a year, and Minucius always ends up well in the black. And without remorse, Minucius is dispensing happiness. Chapter 40. Cowards die many times before their deaths. Shakespeare, Julius Caesar, Act 2, Scene 2. I was always aware of a conflict between Belbo's devotion in working with his respectable Garamond authors, his efforts to get from them books he would be proud of, and the piratical zeal with which he contributed to the swindling of the hapless Minucius authors, even referring to Via Marchese Gualdi those he considered unsuitable for Garamond, as I had seen him attempt to do with Colonel Ardenti. Working with Belbo, I often wondered why he accepted this arrangement. I don't think it was the money. He knew his trade well enough to find a better-paying position. For a long time, I thought he did it because it enabled him to pursue his study of human folly from an ideal observation point. As he never tired of pointing out, he was fascinated by what he called stupidity, the impregnable paralogism, the insidious delirium hidden behind the impeccable argument. But that, too, was a mask. It was Diotelevi who did it for fun, or perhaps hoping that a Minucius book might someday offer an unprecedented combination of the Torah. And I, too, participated for the amusement, the irony, out of curiosity, especially after Garamond launched Project Hermes. For Belbo, it was a different story. This became clear to me after I went into his files. File name, Vendetta. She simply arrives. Even if there are people in the office, she grabs me by my lapels, thrusts her face forward, and kisses me. How does that song go? Anna stands on tiptoe to kiss me. She kisses me as if she were playing pinball. She knows it embarrasses me, puts me on the spot. She never lies. "I love you," she says. "See you Sunday?" "No, I'm spending the weekend with a friend." "A girlfriend, naturally." "No, a man friend. You know him. He was the one who was at the bar with me last week. I promised." "You wouldn't want me to break my promise?" "Don't break your promise, but don't come here to make me..." "Please, I have an author coming in." "A genius to launch?" "A poor bastard to destroy." "A poor bastard to destroy." "I went to pick you up at Pilates. You weren't there. I waited a long time, then I went by myself. Otherwise, the gallery would have been closed.
Somebody there told me you had all gone on to the restaurant. I pretended to look at the pictures, though they tell me Art's been dead since Herdelin. It took me 20 minutes to find the restaurant, because dealers always pick ones that are going to become famous next month. You were there among the usual faces, and beside you was the man with the scar. You weren't the least embarrassed. You looked at me with complicity, and, how do you manage both at the same time, defiance, as if to say, so what? The intruder with the scar looked me up and down, as if I, not he, were the intruder. The others, in on the story, waited. I should have found an excuse to pick a fight. I'd have come out of it well, even if he hit me. Everybody knew you were there with him to provoke me. My role was assigned. One way or the other, I was to put on a show. Since there had to be a show, I chose drawing-room comedy. I joined the conversation, amiable, hoping someone would admire my control. The only one who admired me was me. You're a coward when you feel you're a coward. The Masked Avenger. As Clark Kent, I take care of misunderstood young geniuses. As Superman, I punish justly misunderstood old geniuses. I collaborate in the exploitation of those who, lacking my courage, have been unable to confine themselves to the role of spectator. Is this possible, to spend a life punishing people who will never know they have been punished? So you wanted to be a Homer, eh? Take that, wretch, and that. I hate anyone who tries to see me as an illusion of passion. Chapter 41. When it is recalled that Death is situated at the point where the abyss bisects the middle pillar, and that up the middle pillar lies the path of the arrow, the way by which consciousness goes when the psychic rises on the planes, and that here also is Kundalini, we see that in Death is the secret of both generation and regeneration, the key to the manifestation of all things through the differentiation into pairs of opposites and their union in a third. Dion Fortune, The Mystical Kabbalah, London, Fraternity of the Inner Light, 1957, 719. In any case, I wasn't supposed to concern myself with minutiae. My job was the wonderful adventure of metals. I began by exploring the Milan libraries. I started with textbooks, made a bibliography on file cards, and from there I went back to the original sources, old or new, looking for decent pictures. There's nothing worse than illustrating a chapter on space travel with a photograph of the latest American satellite. Signor Garamond had taught me that it needs, at the very least, an angel by Doré. I reaped a harvest of curious reproductions, but they weren't enough. To choose the right picture for an illustrated book, you have to reject at least 10 others. I got permission to go to Paris for 4 days. Not much time to visit all the archives. Leah came with me. We arrived Thursday and had return reservations for the Monday evening train, and I scheduled the Conservatoire for Monday, a mistake, because I found out the Conservatoire was closed Mondays. Too late. I left Paris crestfallen. Belbo was vexed, but I had collected plenty of interesting things, and we went to show them to Signor Garamond. He leaped through the reproductions, many of them in color, then looked at the bill and let out a whistle. "My dear friend," he said, "our work is a mission, true. We toil in the fields of culture, ça va sans dire, but we're not the Red Cross. More, we're not UNICEF. Was it necessary to buy all this material? I mean, I see here a mustachioed gentleman in his underwear who looks like D'Artagnan, surrounded by abracadabras and Capricorns. Who is he, Mandrake?" "Primitive medicine, influence of the zodiac on the different parts of the body and the corresponding curative herbs, and minerals, including metals. The doctrine of the cosmic signatures. Those were times when the boundary between magic and science was rather ill-defined." "Interesting. But what does this title page mean? Philosophia Mosaica. What's Moses got to do with it? Isn't that being a little too primitive?" "It's the dispute over unguentum armarium, otherwise known as weapon salve. Illustrious physicians spent 50 years arguing whether this salve could heal wounds by being smeared on the weapon that had dealt the blow." "Incredible! And that's science?" "Not in today's sense of the word, but they considered this seriously because they had just discovered the marvels of the magnet, the magic possibility of action at a distance. These men were wrong, but later Volta and Marconi were not. What are electricity and radio if not action at a distance?" "Well, well, bravo, Kasavin. Science and magic going arm in arm, eh? Great idea. Let's pursue this. Throw out some of those revolting generators and put in a few more mandrakes. Perhaps a summoning of the devil, say, on a gold background." I wouldn't want to go too far. This is the wonderful adventure of metals. Oddities work only when they're to the point.
The wonderful adventure of metals must be, most of all, the story of science's mistakes. Stick in the catchy oddity and in the caption say it's wrong. In the meantime, the reader's hooked because he sees that even the greats had crazy ideas, just like him. I told them about a strange thing I had seen in Paris, a bookshop near Quai Saint-Michel. Its symmetrical windows advertised its own schizophrenia. On one side, books on computers and the electronics of the future. On the other, occult sciences. And it was the same inside, Apple and Kabbalah.
Unbelievable, Belbo said.
Obvious, Diotelevi said. Or at least you're the last person who should be surprised, Jacopo. The world of machines seeking to rediscover the secret of creation, letters and numbers.
Garamond said nothing. He had clasped his hands as if in prayer, and his eyes were turned heavenward. Then he smacked his hands together.
What you said today confirms an idea of mine. For a while now, but all in good time. It needs more thought. Meanwhile, carry on. You've done well, Kasavin. We must look at your contract again. You're a valuable colleague. And yes, put in plenty of Kabbalah and computers. Computers are made with silicon, aren't they?
But silicon isn't a metal. It's a non-metallic element.
Metallic, non-metallic. Why split hairs? What is this, Rosa Rosarum? Computers and Kabbalah.
Kabbalah isn't a metal either, I said. He accompanied us to the door. At the threshold, he said,
Kasavin, publishing is an art, not a science. Let's not think like revolutionaries, eh? Those days are past. Put in the Kabbalah.
Oh, yes, about your expenses. I've taken the liberty of disallowing the couchette. Not to be stingy, believe me. It's just that research requires, how shall I put it, a Spartan spirit. Otherwise, you lose your faith.
He summoned us again a few days later, telling Belbo there was a visitor in his office he wanted us to meet.
We went. Garamond was entertaining a fat gentleman with a face like a taper's, no chin, a little blonde mustache beneath a large animal nose. I thought I recognized him, then I knew who it was. Professor Bramante, the man I had gone to hear in Rio, the referendary or whatever of that Rosicrucian order.
Professor Bramante, Garamond said, believes this is the right moment for a smart publisher, alert to the cultural climate of the time, to inaugurate a line of books on the occult sciences.
For Minucius, Belbo suggested.
Why, naturally. Signor Garamond smiled shrewdly.
Professor Bramante, who, by the way, was recommended to me by my dear friend Dr. De Amicis, the author of that splendid volume, Chronicles of the Zodiac, which we brought out this year, has been lamenting the fact that the few works published on this subject, almost invariably by frivolous and unreliable houses, failed to do justice to the wealth, the profundity of this field of studies.
Given the failure of the utopias of the modern world, Bramante said, the time is ripe for a reassessment of the culture of the forgotten past.
What you say is the sacred truth, Professor, but you must forgive our, I don't like to say ignorance, our unfamiliarity with the subject. When you speak of occult sciences, what exactly do you have in mind? Spiritualism? Astrology? Black magic?
Bramante made a gesture of dismay.
Please, that's just the sort of nonsense that's foisted on the ingenuous. I'm talking about science, occult though it may be. Of course, that may include astrology when appropriate, but not the kind that tells a typist that next Sunday she'll meet the man of her dreams. No. What I mean, to give an example, would be a serious study of the Decans.
Oh, yes, I see. Scientific. It's in our line, to be sure, but could you be a little more specific?
Bramante settled into his chair and looked around the room, as if to seek astral inspiration.
I'd be happy to give you some examples, of course. I would say that the ideal reader of a collection of this sort would be a Rosicrucian adept, and therefore an expert in magium, in necromancium, in astrologium, in geomancium, in pyromancium, in hydromancium, in chaomancium, in medicinam adeptam, to quote the book of Azoth, which, as the Raptus Philosophorum explains, was given to Staropus by a mysterious maiden. But the knowledge of the adept embraces other fields, such as physiognosis, which deals with occult physics, the static, the dynamic, and the kinematic, or astrology and esoteric biology, the study of the spirits of nature, Hermetic zoology. I could add cosmognosis, which studies the heavens from the astronomical, cosmological,
physiological and ontological points of view, and anthropognosis, which studies human anatomy and the sciences of divination, psychurgy, social astrology, hermetic history. Then there is qualitative mathematics, arithmology. But the fundamentals are the cosmography of the invisible, magnetism, auras, fluids, psychometry, and clairvoyance, and in general the study of the five hyperphysical senses, not to mention horoscopic astrology, which of course becomes a mere mockery of learning when not conducted with the proper precautions, as well as physiognomics, mind-reading, and the predictive arts, tarots, dream books, ranging to the highest levels, such as prophecy and ecstasy. Sufficient information would be required on alchemy, spagyrics, telepathy, exorcism, ceremonial and evocatory magic, basic theurgy. As for genuine occultism, I would advise exploration of the fields of early Kabbalah, Brahmanism, Gymnosophy, Memphis hieroglyphics, Templar phenomenology, Belbo slipped in. Bramante glowed. Absolutely. But I almost forgot. First, some idea of necromancy and sorcery among the other races. Onomancy, prophetic furies, voluntary thaumaturgy, hypnotic suggestion, yoga, somnambulism, mercurial chemistry. For the mystical tendency, Vronsky advises bearing in mind the techniques of the possessed nuns of Loudon, the convulsives of Saint-Médard, the mystical beverages, the wine of Egypt, the elixir of life, and arsenic water. For the principle of evil, but I realize that here we come to the most delicate part of a possible series, I would say we need to acquaint the reader with the mysteries of Beelzebub as destruction proper, with Satan as dethroned prince, and with Uranomius, Moloch, Incubi, and Succubi. For the positive principle, the celestial mysteries of St. Michael, Gabriel, Raphael, and the Agatha demons. Then, of course, the mysteries of Isis, Mithra, Morpheus, Samothrace, and Eleusis, and the natural mysteries of the male sex, Phallus, Wood of Life, Key of Science, Baphomet, Mallet, then the natural mysteries of the female sex. Ceres, Tyus, Patera, Cybele, Astarte. Signor Garamond leaned forward with an insinuating smile. I wouldn't overlook the Gnostics. Certainly not, although on that particular subject a great deal of rubbish is in circulation. In any case, every sound form of occultism is a gnosis. Just what I was going to say, said Garamond. And all this would be enough? Belbo asked innocently. And all this would be enough? Belbo asked innocently. Bramante puffed out his cheeks, abruptly transforming himself from taper to hamster. Enough? To begin with, yes, but not for beginners, if you'll forgive the little joke. But with about 50 volumes, you could enthrall an audience of thousands, readers who are only waiting for an authoritative word. With an investment of perhaps a few hundred million lire... I've come to you personally, Dr. Garamond, because I know of your willingness to undertake such generous ventures, and with a modest royalty for myself as editor-in-chief of the series. Bramante had now gone too far. Garamond was losing interest. The visitor was dismissed hastily with expansive promises. The usual committee of advisers would carefully weigh the proposal.